Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. Today, I'm joined by Will Reinhardt, who's the Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum, and is probably one of, at least part of the first generation of Americans to have a graduate degree that covers social networking.
Yeah, I mean, yep.
Glad to have you, Will.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm obviously I'm a big fan of the podcast, and I've been listening to it for a while, so it's great to finally be on.
Well, I think that's the best way to reward our fans is to let them,
put them on.
Yeah. But yeah, you wrote a blog post this week that I think really encapsulates the issues behind this recent sort of what Tony Romm is calling the privacy oil spill.
Yeah.
Involving Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, and I guess the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Where you focused on the three big, it's on Medium, and the title's answering the three big questions surrounding Cambridge Analytica. This is a subject that really needs some clarification because I have not actually read a single account of it that I would consider to be 100% accurate. I mean,
yeah.
With the exception of yours.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, and there's obviously not any reason to ask you why you wrote this. I mean, this is pretty much, you know, nowadays you sort of like, why are you discussing something other than Cambridge Analytica? So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest, I've been interested in, I mean, social media and social networks for quite some time, for, you know, nearly going on a decade. So this is something that I've been, you know, done research in, and I'm actually just really fascinated by it.
Well, and I've been following your work for a long time, and so I turned to you because I figured if anybody had a good analysis of it, you would.
Well, thanks. We'll see how good my analysis is once we get finished with everything.
Well, and you know, the discussion on this issue is really still at the beginning. I mean, we may be at the end of the beginning, but you know, we've got a long ways to go.
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah. So let's get into your three questions. So I think the first one is, what information did Cambridge Analytica get from Facebook, and how did they get it?
Yeah, so it seems that Cambridge Analytica had some sort of demographic information, and this is actually one of the areas where we're not exactly clear. So stepping back for a second, you know, Cambridge Analytica, it seems, was trying to get into the American political data space, which if you work in Washington, you'll come into contact with people who work in this space who do, you know, background analytics and work to figure out where, you know, where we should put people on the ground and what kind of polls should we ask and who should we target in order to get people out for various elections.
And so this is a really critical part of recent elections, right? I mean,
you
know, the winners of the recent presidential elections, probably the last three or four campaigns have really been praised for having such a great game with data and their connection between the data and the social activities. Like, you know, when you want to tell a supporter to talk to a neighbor or a friend because the neighbor or friend is influenceable.
Yes.
You know, that's part of what we expect our data analysts to do now.
True. And that was very common up until about 2014. From about 2010 to 2014, that was fairly common for these apps. Today has shifted just a little bit, which we can talk about here in a bit. But really, I think what Cambridge Analytica was doing was they were trying to get into this big data space in politics. And so it seems that at the time, for whatever reason, they didn't create an app, but they worked with another researcher, an academic, to get information on psychographic data. And psychographic data, as they were talking about at the time, was these kind of profiles that delineate people into, you know, six or so groups so that you can target advertisements and target marketing to them very at a micro targeting level. So in order to do this, you know, they first went to this kind of psychographic research institute in Cambridge. This is based in, you know, the company's based in Cambridge, but you know, there's a lot of people at University of Cambridge who were working very closely on these you know, these profiles. This kind of well-known institute didn't said they wouldn't work with Cambridge Analytica, so instead they went with one of the researchers. His name is Dr. Kogan, and he ended up helping to build an app that that eventually Cambridge Analytica kind of supported. And that app, you know, it was deployed in 2013, the end of 2013. And then it was, they effectively hired people through Mechanical Turk, through Amazon's Mechanical Turk, to go ahead and, you know, download the app and then take a set of questions, and then they got money after they did these kind of question and answers.
Okay. So this brings us to maybe the first clarification. The, one of the media narratives is that, Kogan had a kind of special relationship with Facebook because he went to Facebook as a researcher, said that he wanted to get sensitive data from Facebook, and that's what he ended up selling to Cambridge Analytica. It's not really true, though, is it? I mean, didn't he have the same data that any app developer can get from Facebook?
Oh, very much so. So under the very first version of Facebook's API, the ability to get data on your friends was you know, a pretty big pull for marketers and researchers. Yeah. I mean, even, you know, I was, I remember this in grad school, that we actually did this as a kind of a research tool, that we would, you know, you would go on to your profile, you would download some programming tools that we were developing in-house at the time, and you would actually map your own, you know, social network and use some demographic data to understand what, you know, what your friends were like, and how, you know, understanding like the demographic data of your friends. Mm-hmm. It was really, really easy to do this. And in fact, I, somewhere located in one of my subfolders from grad school is actually some data on this, on my own profile, demographic information about my friends. So mm-hmm. it was an easy thing to get at the time. And you really didn't need a special license to get that kind of information. You didn't need a special license to download the kind of data that Cambridge Analytica eventually got.
There's an article in The Atlantic that supports that view, that it's called "My Cal Game Extracted Your Facebook Data."
Yeah. I was just talking to my dad about this morning, and exactly, that a lot of marketers use this method. They would ask people, okay, you know, they'd ask them a series of questions. It was done through quiz style, and, you know, some of the answers would be then, you know, inputted into a large database that those marketers would then use.
Yeah. And so the thing that's so remarkable about Facebook as a game platform is that, you know, Facebook has all this information about all the Facebook users. If you develop a game for the Facebook platform, up until quite recently, you had access to pretty much everything that Facebook knew about all of it, the users that were connected to the users of your game.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
which is,
oh,
very it's much so. Really, it's really kind of awesome. But I mean, so why was it so ridiculously open? Is it just because it was easier? It's easier to, you know, for openness to be the default than for someone to curate the data?
I think the other thing that we need to remember is the change in context about what was going on at the time. And, you know, I hint also at this, you know, a bit in my piece, but it was at the time it was, you know, everyone talked about openness, and there was this positivity surrounding social networks and what social networks could do. So I think the context at the time was, you know, the privacy concerns that we have now in 2018 were very, very different than the kinds of privacy concerns that we had even back then. And there was a combination of things that effectively happened. You know, we've had kind of all the, you know, had a string of stories about Google and Facebook over the last year. And so people have become very heightened to this concern. You know, at the time there were people who worried about data being leaked through this manner. And to be honest, they, you know, not a lot of people listened to them. Not to say they shouldn't have been listened to, but it just wasn't a big concern at the time. Probably.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the era in which Facebook was founded, I recall, you know, there were, the cool kids of the internet, people like Jeff Jarvis and, Shirky and those folks. Jarvis in particular was really touting the benefits of publicness. I mean, didn't he write a book called Public Parts or something like that?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
when he got prostate surgery, and he went through a big thing on his blog and everywhere about, you know, his, like, step by step is about his whole prostate surgery. And it was sort of this kind of a social thing where, instead of privacy being the default attribute of personal information, he thought everything should basically be public, and we should just sort of get used to living fully transparent lives.
Yeah, and that was a big part of the conversation, you know, right around the time that all this was developed. Mm. The other part of it was that, you know, part of it that is the other thing that is important to remember in this context is that the app community itself is pretty small. You know, obviously it really helped propel Facebook's growth, the opening of the, you know, the API and kind of developing content on top.
Yeah, like 9 million apps.
Oh, yeah, yeah. but at the time, really, the, you know, this was new. I mean, it's, again, it's important to remember that at the time that Facebook opened up, if I have my dates correct, Facebook was the first one to effectively open up their API. This was actually before
the social graph API.
Yeah. The social graph API, so that, you know, content can be built on top of it. And this was even before the app store had opened for iPhone, because effectively, again, if I'm remembering this correctly, Steve Jobs basically said, yeah, you know, they were actually taken a little back by what happened with Facebook and in the pretty swift growth of Facebook after they had created their own version, after Facebook had created effectively the app store. So this is also just a new kind of new technology. Writ large was this, the app economy. I mean, the app economy has developed, you know, and Mike Mandel has some really good data on this. I actually haven't checked in it recently, but, you know, the app economy has grown to from basically nothing in 2009, 2010 to, you know, it's a quite a significant economic, you know, part of the economy. I think he puts it in billions, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think it's a fraction of the economy with a single digit denominator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's huge.
So, yeah, I mean, this was, so the other thing that's, in, so, you know, the, what happened then with the data, at least with Cambridge Analytica, well, step back for a second and this, the entire relationship between data and political campaigning seems to have really taken off with Obama in 2012. And mm-hmm. that's really where, you know, Obama's digital campaign was given a lot of accolades for that. Mm-hmm. And what they ended up doing was, it seems they probably ended up collecting, even though I mean, they've said that effectively they have demographic data or had demographic data on effectively almost every 90, I think it was 98% of Americans, mm-hmm. In the 2012 election. But the way that they used the way that they use their own app. And again, the important difference between what the Obama campaign did and what Cambridge Analytica did was Cambridge Analytica wasn't transparent in their collection of data. Whereas, you know, to the extent that they were, you know, effectively using data that was collected for one purpose, mm-hmm. you know, through this other app, through the academic.
Well, I mean, the one clear thing that Cambridge Analytica and the original researcher, the Kogan guy, mm-hmm. did wrong was that Kogan wasn't supposed to share that information that he collected with his app with Cambridge Analytica.
Exactly. And that's part of the, yeah. that's part of the general API license. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to share that third party data. So that is in fact where the, you know, the problems really arise is in the sharing of that third person data.
Mm-hmm. And this Kogan guy has got some odd connections with Russia too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some really there. I'll just say this. He seems like an interesting fellow. I don't know too much about him, but I'm sure, you know, in the coming months, we'll hear more about him.
I mean, he's an associate professor at some Russian university, mm-hmm. as well as some sort of professor. I don't know what category with at Cambridge. But yeah, he wasn't supposed to share the data.
Yes.
And as a result, I think he's Facebook's kicked him out, right? He can't get any.
Yeah.
But
very much so.
But, you know, he claims he's deleted the data and Facebook says they're going to audit him, but that hadn't happened yet.
No. And he also, you know, he had said, Cambridge Analytica also said that they had deleted the data. And what's new really about this report that came out on, I think, Saturday or Sunday from the New York Times is the claim that they in fact didn't delete the data. So this story has kind of been bubbling over the last couple of years, and you know, this is something that I don't know if I you know, I remember following it when it first broke in 2016, about Cambridge Analytica and the data, and there was a whole bunch of Wired, you know, write-ups, and this has kind of been in, you know, in the background. This idea has, or this, you know, this event has been there, that Cambridge Analytica somehow had access to this Facebook data that it shouldn't have had. But, you know, campaigns of all stripes were using this data. They would create.
Well, I mean, the Obama campaign got similar data just because they had a Facebook page and they asked people to you know, like the page, and they consciously shared information with the campaign because they supported it. And, you know, they, you can then, once you have a certain core group of permissions, you can construct the graph from that, from their friends, right? And their,
very effectively. It's really, really easy to do that.
And I think some of the interesting math about this was that the Kogan's app had maybe 100,000 users, and he ended up, you know, getting information from like 50 million because it's just the power of the social graph.
Yep.
So the 6 degrees of separation or 2 degrees of separation from Kogan.
Yeah. Facebook's actually done an entire mapping of the social network of the world. And it's I forgot how far the greatest distance is, but it's less than 6 degrees.
Yeah. And so you don't even have to be a Facebook user. You just have to know somebody who's a Facebook user, or maybe visit a website that Facebook has a tracker on. I mean, it's pretty much pervasive. But so indeed, this wasn't then actually. I'll go ahead.
Oh, no, no. And the one thing I was going to mention about that is that even if you, I mean, this is something that Facebook has gotten into trouble in the past, which, you know, was related to an Irish court case about 2 or 3 years ago, you know, about these shadow profiles. I mean, as soon as you connect with an individual, because we generally know what social networks kind of look like in practice, that if somebody's not in a social network and yet they should be there, it's relatively easy to tell. It's not a very difficult thing to tell if somebody should actually be within a network and yet isn't showing up in the data.
So, well, I mean, you could draw the same inferences from looking at Gmail, right?
Yes, very much so. Oh, very much so.
Yeah, you get emails that are sent by people who are not Gmail subscribers, but they're communicating with someone who is. And with the all the the address information about how the emails are being distributed, you can tell who these people's contacts are. I mean, there's obviously a certain amount of inference involved in it, which kind of reminds me, once upon a time, Congress actually considered regulating email under Title II.
That is, doesn't that seem so far away from where we are now with these conversations? It's odd to go back to these, to, you know, 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago to see these conversations. I mean, Gmail, the fact that Gmail or Hotmail rather was free, that was, you know, there was talk about regulating it back then.
Well, and, so, you know, the messaging services like WhatsApp, there's not really a whole lot of difference between WhatsApp, Twitter, and SMS, right?
But no, effectively no.
But they have different providers, so they, you know, they fall in different regulatory categories. But that's a topic for another day. So this wasn't actually a data breach, right? I mean, a lot of people.
I mean, what we would normally think of as a data breach, and what you would typically think of legally as a data breach, no. I mean, data breach typically requires two items. One is, you know, that you have both an acquisition of information, but also a, you know, that information itself has to be covered. So, you know, this is health data and financial data. And, you know, again, I could be completely wrong on this, but from what I've seen in the reports, nothing really seems to suggest that this kind of the sensitive data was shared. So the sensitive data that we're talking about would be, you know, a social security number or a bank account number, or, you know, something, you know, login
would be regarded by HIPAA and the other federal privacy laws as sensitive.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, there isn't a federal data breach notification, or if, you know, there aren't really these, you know, there's there, there's a whole bunch of different ways that data breach, the kind of the covered sensitive information can be defined under data breach laws. And, you know, my home state of Illinois has probably the most expansive version of that because it also includes biometric data, effectively right. pictures of individuals are included under sensitive data. Mm. But again, from what I've seen in the reporting, there's nothing to suggest that type of sensitive information was shared. So at the end of the day, then, you know, was it a data breach? You know, legally speaking, from what we understand about a data breach, no. Did the
data left Facebook properly according to their terms and conditions? Was received from Facebook by a company that had dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's to acquire the data from Facebook? And the event that took place, the troublesome part was the sharing of the information by Kogan after he got it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not really a breach. That's just sort of an unauthorized sale.
Yeah, exactly. Which puts us into
it's not good, but
no, yeah. And it also puts us into this weird legal gray zone that I don't, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I haven't, you know, in talking to people who've been following this really closely, I don't know that there's a lot of really great case law on this.
But he had some sort of contract with Facebook. But it seems like if anyone has standing to go after him, to punish him for sharing that information, it'd probably be Facebook.
Yes, it would be. Yeah. And it seems that they knew that something happened along these lines in 2015 that he had shared. In 2015, it seems that there's back and forth, between Kogan and Cambridge Analytica and obviously Facebook about the data. Mm-hmm. And they had sent him, you know, they had sent him a number of emails and asked if he had deleted it. And they said, yes, we have deleted it. We haven't included it, in our profiles. And really, again, what the story that broke recently was really on this point, whether or not they had deleted the data that they said that they had deleted in 2015. So,
but the, I think the reason that especially The Guardian and The New York Times are just, The Guardian in particular is just really worked up about this entire event because, you know, they talked to the former employee of Cambridge Analytica, the kid with the pink hair,
Wiley.
Yeah, Wiley. And he's really kind of, it almost seems like he's play acting to try to get in the good graces of the various social communities that he moves in because he's ashamed of the role that he played in making this information available. But, you know, the claims that he's making and The Guardian and The New York Times to a certain extent are making is that this psychographic information is so important and so powerful and so massively predictive that it gave Steve Bannon the ability to get into the minds of voters and basically swing the election for Trump.
Yes, that's, if you couldn't hear it, that was me sighing very loud. That I think is a pretty common narrative, but it really is, that just doesn't hold up.
It's the typical, there's elements of the losing side's narrative in almost every election, and I think the left is a little bit better at this or is worse at this about this than the right is. When the voters don't support your candidate, well, the voters were just wrong. So the question is, what made the voters do the wrong thing?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so we have to come up, you know, it can't simply be that they rejected our candidate because they didn't like her. Or because she failed to offer them, you know, what they were looking for in a presidential candidate, or they just wanted to shake up the system, or, you know, somehow they really like people with orange hair or whatever, you know. It's got to be, you know, someone had to make them go wrong. So that's their narrative, right?
Indeed. The reason why that at least fails in this instance is that it seems that that Cambridge Analytica's data wasn't even used for the general election from October on. Ooh. In really the, yeah, which to me, I have a number of friends who work in this space and I've asked them about this, and it, you know, even though it's not absolutely abundantly clear who, you know, It's not abundantly clear, you know, no one's really willing to go on record to say what, you know, what exactly happened, but it seems for the most part, it was, you know, traditional RNC data, which is understandable because RNC data, this is the Republican National Committee, their data goes back for, you know, I know at least a decade, probably more.
Well, I mean, that,
on voter intentions,
you know, they've been collecting this, you know, voter profile information and refining it for a long time. This is not
exactly new, right. Exactly. And you figure, and that's actually better. That's actually much, much better data at the end of the day, which is the other reason why I'm so, this has been a little bit head scratching for me, because, you know, what you're really looking for in a political campaign is you kind of just want to figure out who's going to vote for your candidate. And, you know, the idea that an ad campaign is going to have these massive sways over voter behavior, you know, there's not, advertisements really only work in very specific instances. They work, you know, they work when it's, you know, when the advertisement was, if it was a day or two ago, you know, there's this effect on when it comes to time. So, you know, it doesn't really last much more than a week or so in your mind, because you just kind of move on to other things. Mm-hmm. If the candidate's unknown, then advertisements are good because it just lets people know, hey, there is X person, either he or she is running for this seat. So, you know, just to let you know, this is what that, you know, this is the person. But for the most part, the kind of weaponization of advertisements, it doesn't work like that in practice. Mm-hmm. The individuals aren't swayed immensely by these campaigns, or at least most of the research that has looked at them. We don't see that sort of, you know, intense reaction to advertisements.
Well, wasn't this the kind of election that ultimately came down to turnout?
Indeed. And the other thing that's important to remember is that, you know, if there is any criticism on Trump voters largely didn't read Facebook. They were almost completely tied to traditional media, and and they didn't go to Facebook. They didn't go to Twitter. Uh-huh. Younger individuals who use Facebook and Twitter for their primary news content and use the platform, by and large, they're far more. They typically tend to vote Democratic, but even then, they're still highly diverse in their information consumption needs. So they're not just going on Facebook, you know, they're going on to, you know, CNN or even Reddit more to read news content. So there's just a lot of real big holes in this narrative that, you know, CA was able to weaponize advertisements like they did.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that psychographic is not what CA claims it is. It's not there yet. And it probably never will be there, because it's not your psychological profile that makes you excited about a certain political candidate, et cetera things, right?
Indeed. And this is what the Obama campaign also worked with, was trying to figure out people who would have an interest in the candidate, but who hadn't shown that they were going to go out and vote yet. Mm-hmm. So it's the Obama campaign used the data in a bit of a different method, which was, they're not trying to advertise, you know, they're not trying to target advertisements. They're trying to get those individuals to go out and vote, considering that they know that here are probably the likely people that would vote for Obama, given what is known about them.
Yeah. One thing that's been remarkably absent from this discussion about CA and Facebook and Trump and Bannon is that Hillary's campaign had spent an enormous amount of money developing what they thought was a very sophisticated tech platform to identify voter preferences and help organize the ground game and collect money and target advertising. I mean, they were really bragging. I mean, did a whole lot of media stuff. I wrote a couple of blog posts about that. This amazing top-down, all-knowing, all-seeing computer program that the Clinton campaign built that I think ultimately proved to be pretty ineffective.
Yeah, there's been a number of Wired reports on this as well, that it wasn't as effective as the RNC's ground game. You know, quietly, the Republican National Committee has put a lot of money and effort into developing out you know, digital tech. And, you know, to be quite blunt, it was actually, you know, before Obama really kind of opened up this game, it was actually Karl Rove's organization, American Crossroads, that actually did a lot of this you know, micro targeting work, which, I mean, at the end of the day, the other thing that I guess, you know, as somebody who works in algorithmic creation and has kind of worked with this, you know, with this kind of data before, is that you really don't need psychographic data. All you really have to do at the end of the day is just say, okay, we're going to assume that there are, you know, 10 or 12 different kinds of buckets of individuals, you know, people that are likely to vote for a candidate, people that are, you know, that are very much in our camp and we don't need to do that much outreach to, you know, people that are never going to be on our side, people that could, with a little bit of swaying, could be on our side. And so really what you're trying to achieve is a voter outcome that looks very different than what you would necessarily want with kind of psychographic data. At the end of the day, really what you're looking for is just you want to try to figure out which individuals are going to vote for your candidate. And
you don't care about their psychological profile. You care about their willingness to vote for your candidate.
Exactly.
Yeah, you take votes from anybody you can get them from.
And I ended up talking with somebody who works in these political campaigns on the data side. And, you know, he said, I often put in psychometric like data because it sells well. People like to see it. He's like, it's not really effective, but it makes people more confident that I'm giving them kind of a holistic product, and that it's just not, and that this data that I'm selling them, or this data analytics that I'm selling them, isn't just voodoo.
Yeah. So it really is. You know, you may be running the whole thing from a Ouija board, but if you cover it up with a bunch of kind of sciencey sounding stuff, it's an easier sell.
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, the micro-targeting data, figuring out individuals, going and, you know, having a ground game, knocking on the doors, that is by far the most effective method. And, you know, having people organized at the local level that can give, you know, they can give rides to individuals that are going to vote. I mean, it takes much, much more than just advertisements to get somebody elected. And that is what seems to me to be the most worrying part of all this. It's like there's a big, huge campaign that's behind these individuals. And if you think that the advertising data is it's oftentimes the flashiest part of a campaign, but it's usually not, it's important, but it's usually not the most important part, which is just a solid ground game, getting people knocking and, you know, figuring out who's going to vote and making sure they turn out when election day comes.
Yeah, it's sort of like writing poetry. It's not really what's in your head that counts. It's what you can get down on the page.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's great, Will. I think this has been a really worthwhile conversation that helped clarify an awful lot of this. I understand Congress, a couple of different committees in Congress are competing to be the host to Mark Zuckerberg.
We'll see if he shows up.
Come to the Hill, and he's indicated a willingness, I think, to finally go to the Hill. And he's hadn't 100% committed, but he said that if he's the most appropriate person, he'll be there. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see Zuckerberg with maybe a data policy person in tow. But I sort of think that we're kind of in a scapegoating mode now, where we're blaming this alleged breach, which isn't really a breach, on Facebook for having policies that are no longer its policies. That,
yep, exactly.
Because they influenced an election which they didn't actually have much effect on at all. And so it's, well, I guess, you know, wouldn't be the first time in Washington we'd had a little political theater on the Hill.
But I think that's what's most interesting about this is it ties up all of these kinds of not loose ends, but it ties up a lot of themes that have happened over the last couple of years. It ties up this big question about politics and what democratic politics should, you know, what the small d democratic politics should look like. Mm-hmm. And with this bigger question about what's the influence of, you know, of social media platforms on individuals' lives, you know, combine that with this, you know, problem of, you know, tech, just generally individuals being addicted to technology. And I mean, this story comes at a fortuitous time. It comes at the time at which individuals are sensitive and are are potentially interested in hearing this.
Well, it's really difficult to get Congress to pay attention to tech policy issues because they're just they're so challenging.
And so yes.
So I think that's kind of the oil spill analogy, is that something happened that a lot of people are upset about, so Congress is willing to take some action. Remains to be seen whether the action will be just sort of the typical kind of random, yeah, we're doing something, don't, you know, we didn't forget you, or it'll be something that meaningfully advances the state of tech policy.
I think that going forward, what you'll probably end up seeing is something small carve out. I mean, I know a lot of people have talked about comprehensive data regulation or comprehensive privacy regulation, but I think probably what will end up happening is probably a carve out, you know, a whole bunch of mea culpas from Facebook. And, you know, they've also signaled that they're going to be changing some of their privacy policies. There was a New York Times report about this yesterday. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens and how Facebook deals with this.
Yeah, Zuck wrote a post on Facebook about, with the mea culpas and what they're going to do. But, I mean, in a sense, what I'd like to see happen out of this is that people come to understand that platforms, when we want to regulate privacy and other sort of aspects of good social behavior on the internet, platforms are platforms. It doesn't matter whether the platform is an ISP like Comcast or Verizon, or a social platform like Google, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix. You run into the same issues. And if we're going to be comprehensive in our privacy policies, then I think they have to be applied uniformly across the whole space.
And the one thing I would mention also about that is we have to get a kind of a grip on this question of harm, which, you know, we've kind of danced around that during this entire conversation, but you know, this question of harm, how were consumers harmed? How were individuals harmed? That's a tough one for this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's a universally a tough issue when it comes to privacy. So it's easy to say when somebody's harmed, when, you know, their bank account is stolen and a whole bunch of money is taken out. But you know, when you have these intangible harms where it's really difficult to figure out what the actual effect the individuals, you know, that actually occurred. And, you know, the other part of this is that had this story, I mean, this story's kind of been brewing. If this story didn't break in the way that it's currently breaking, would there actually have been any harm? Would people have noticed that there was actually harm involved? The intangible harm comes not necessarily from, you know, stolen money, but the story itself. And that's also its own kind of, you know, bigger question, that the more and more we start focusing on these data breaches or you know, not, I mean, not in this case, but the more and more we start focusing on data breaches and data, you know, release of information, the more individuals get heightened to it. So the more that they feel harm, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are indeed harmed by this. And so it's just a whole bunch of,
well, you know, frankly, I feel more harm from the alarming stories I've read in the Guardian. I mean, they didn't influence me to vote for Trump. I'm not, you know, don't put that on me. But yeah, I mean, harm, when we're talking about psychological harm.
Yep. It's a,
boy, is that ever a can of worms?
Yep. Exactly. Especially when we're trying to do good.
You know, most of this information is in the hands of advertisers, and they want us to, you know, to check out and probably buy their product. So, but at the end of the day, if I buy a box of Tide instead of a box of All, I don't, you know, it's hard to really establish that much harm was done.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I've also done a little bit of my own surveys on these Facebook, you know, these Facebook categories. And one of the things that I've noticed is they're all right, but they're not perfect. Mm-hmm. So what they think is what they, the person they think that you are isn't always who you are. Mm-hmm.
Pretend to be on Facebook are not really the people we are in real life. I mean, it's a lot of people have kind of pointed out that maybe the point of Facebook is to show the people you went to high school with that you live a better life than they do.
Well, I don't do any posting on Facebook, so apparently I'm doing something wrong.
Uh-huh. Well, plenty of time to make up for that.
I don't know. I've actually thought about leaving Facebook and leaving Twitter just for pure productivity reasons.
Well, yeah, and there's sort of a campaign now that, you know, people want
to delete, yeah.
Yeah, leave Facebook to show their dissatisfaction with the election outcome. But, you know, I think probably the best way to do that is next time there's an election, instead of sitting home and griping about your choices, probably get out and vote.
And, you know, just kind of, you know, I don't want to take too much longer, but the one thing that I think that is probably the big takeaway from people who are working in public policy, and this is something I haven't, you know, I haven't seen a lot of work done. And I think probably if Facebook wanted to deal with this problem, one thing that I think that they probably could do is actually work with people who do media literacy and kind of figure out some sort of, I don't want to say program, but some sort of, I don't know, syllabus or some sort of project to have people be more conscientious about their use of technology.
Right. We need to start educating kids, probably starting in elementary school, about, you know, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, kids.
And there's other better, more fun things to do than sit around on Facebook and Snapchat all day.
Play baseball. How about
that? Take apart a clock, you know, go look at space.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably some evidence that Facebook isn't that much a kid's platform today anyway. It's more like old people, like grandparents. Maybe the fundamental use in the next 4 or 5 years will just be grandparents seeing pictures or videos of their grandchildren.
Yeah, and that could be just the natural evolution of the social media that you know, kids looking for something new and something different constantly search for, you know, each generation constantly searches for its social network to be a part of.
Yeah. I mean, I think the kids want to have their own space where the grownups are not over their shoulders looking at what they're doing.
True. And, you know, I remember Facebook. My university was among the first that was on Facebook. I remember growing up with it through college. So it's very much for somebody who is, you know, who is a millennial, it's really been a central part of my life for now going on, you know, what, 15 years almost. I mean,
wow.
I think that's about how long, because after Harvard opened it up to Stanford and a couple others. Indeed. So there's a group of us that Facebook really is the way that we connected with individuals, and, you know, it was our version of the telephone. So, but maybe not so much for my cousins, especially. They're much more Snapchat and
We've been refining the telephone network for 100 years, and probably in another 75, we'll probably have Facebook just about right.
We can only hope.
Yeah. Title 18 of the Communications Act will get it all straight.
I'm still waiting for Title 10.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So that's a wrap, folks. This is your host, Richard Bennett, with the High Tech Forum podcast and the hightechforum.org website. So feel free to leave us a comment on the website, or if you found out about this podcast from iTunes, you know, you can leave it there. And come back in the next couple of weeks or so. We'll have another podcast on an issue of maybe not equal significance, but certainly something relevant to current public policy debates over the internet. So see you then.